West Cliff, Colorado, early in 1967. The subject of the interview is Mrs. Dora Lang, and Mrs. Riggs is doing the interviewing.
Are you a native-born Custer County?
Mm-hmm.
Right. And how long ago? How many years ago?
It'll be 83 this 29th of May.
Oh, we're very near your birthday then.
Yeah.
We'll have to have a celebration. And you're still real active and live by yourself.
Yeah.
You, where were you born, Mrs. Lang?
7 miles south of West Cliff.
Do you have any identification? Did they call this community any particular name like Colfax or?
No.
No. What was your maiden name?
Lang. Knut.
Knut. Mm-hmm. Now that is a real old one, goes way back.
Yeah.
would you tell us what you know about the arrival of the German colony?
Well, my mother and father, they came to America in 1868, settling in Chicago. They was there for more years, and father wasn't well there, so they come out with the colonies. 1870, they from Chicago settling here in the valley. I think there was about 14 families that come out that time.
How did they come, Mrs. Lang?
Well, with oxen, and there was no railroads nor anything here.
Now, this was 1870.
Yeah.
Was the first colony 1869?
No, that was just when they started out from Germany to come to Chicago.
Oh, and your folks had been in Chicago for a while.
Well, since 1870, from
67 to 70, or 60. Probably 2 years. You said they left Chicago in 1869. And they left with oxen team from Chicago?
Well, I think so, because they didn't have nothing else to go by.
Now, what route did they come into Custer County?
Well, I couldn't tell you that.
This is something I wanted to clear up, and I'll put it on this tape, because lately I've been reading all I can about the arrival of the colony, and I have read that everything from coming up the Warfennel through the Gardiner country to up the Hartsgravel and even the Oak Creek route. Mm-hmm. And you don't know which one they
I don't really know.
Mm-hmm. Did your mother ever tell you anything about the trip from Chicago, did she?
Well, she didn't tell me much. See, I was the youngest, and by the time I grew up so I could ask her so many questions, she kind of forgot things.
Mm-hmm. You don't recall any good stories of danger along the way or anything like that?
Well, no, she didn't say. Only when they got here, I know there was Indians here. Because Wilson, he was, I don't know, I guess he was the overseer, you know. He had the flour and such a stuff, you know. And then each family could come each day and get some. So they have to divide it so they get along. And when she went over there to get some flour one day, she come back and here was an Indian in the house standing looking at the baby.
Oh dear.
But
did that frighten her?
No, she kind of, she'd seen him once before. And then he was standing there and he liked buttermilk, so she gave him a pail of buttermilk and he went on. He never hurt the baby at all.
He just
he
wanted
said
to look
something,
at
him. But she couldn't understand him, and he couldn't understand her.
Do you happen to know what tribe that was?
No, I couldn't say.
I don't believe I've ever heard either. I've heard a reference, but no one's ever been able to tell me what tribe they were.
Yeah.
Were they here, do you think, just in the summertime, or were they here year-round, the Indians?
Well, I wouldn't just exactly know.
Mm-hmm. Now, this colony, would you tell me something about the setup on the sort of socialistic idea of community property when they first came?
Well, they had that, I guess they first settled there at Colfax. And then, of course, after a while, they switched took up some land, I guess. And
well, the first, didn't they sort of have it, as I said, as a socialistic bit? You mentioned your mother checking out supplies from the wagon master or whoever was the head of the colony.
Yeah.
Now, I understand that this was the idea, that it was to be a colony of people sharing together and working together.
Yeah.
But this didn't work.
No.
And so what, a year or 2 years after they came, they separated and went their own individual way. I wonder, could you tell me something about the formation of your church here?
Well, there was the 14 families that they was Lutherans, you know, and they tried to get a congregation, but there was no pastor around, and the first pastor come from Nebraska. And when he come up here, he'd either have to walk behind the wagon or he'd have to pace awful much for the coming up from Pueblo to Canyon and then this way. So they said that he better not preach, otherwise they'd hang him.
Who said this?
It was some of the people, you know, where he wanted to preach in Pueblo.
Oh, I see.
And find out how many Lutherans there was there. So they said they better not start that or they'd hang him. Well, that was no good.
So he came on up here?
He came up, yeah. He walked behind the wagon, some freighter come up, and then he went around here and he found 14 families that would want to join a congregation.
Can you tell me, can you name those 14 families, or most of them?
Well, now read the
names. Yes, just read the names.
John Knut, William Alkaline, August Menzel, Gottlieb Ogreski, Isar, Carson Kunrad, Fritz Keen, Fritz Sieski, Heinrich Kettler, August Closey, William Henius, Gerbert Hartbauer, Heinrich Gosen, Fred Waldick. That's all.
That's the original Lutheran colonists, and of course this German Lutheran, naturally.
Yeah.
And do you know what year the minister came? Do you happen to have that in your record?
And November the 12th, 1872.
So it didn't take them long after they had a settlement to get a minister.
Uh-huh.
And he was here a number of years, I believe. Do you know his name, Mrs. Lang?
H.W. Heyman.
Heyman.
Mm-hmm.
Now that's one that's new to me. And when you were reading the 14 families, this was the first time I realized the Hartbauers were the original colony. I'd heard most of the others, you know, as reference. Go ahead and read us what you have there, and we'll get it on tape, okay?
In September of 1873, the congregation received their first pastor. On the 13th Sunday after Trinity, candidate H.W. Heyman was ordained by the Reverend H. Brower of Denver. The service being conducted in the unfinished log cabin on the William Knut place, about 5.5 miles southwest of West Cliff. Chairs had been provided for the two pastors while the congregation sat on planks. During the rite for ordination, Pastor Heyman knelt on the bare ground. Now that's all from that, unless the building then.
Mm-hmm. What was the first church? Where was the first church built?
You know where Willie Knut lives out here?
Yes.
This was on that place.
Oh.
It wasn't where the house was, it was farther down in the field.
Do you know, have you ever heard that church described, or did you ever go to church there yourself?
No, see, I wasn't born then yet.
How many were in your family?
Eight.
Eight children?
Seven girls and one boy.
Oh, I'll bet he wasn't spoiled.
Well, he was an invalid. He passed away at 17 years.
Oh, that was very tragic, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Do you have more in regard to the church? Because this is something that nobody has touched on at all, is your Lutheran church.
Well, this is what it is made of.
Go right ahead and read it if you'd like, Mrs. Lang.
Church building. The congregation soon built a small church of aspen poles about 12 by 20 feet on August Menzel's place. The building originally stood about 1/2 mile southeast of the present William Knut buildings. This first church of the congregation had neither floor nor windows and was used only about 8 months. A class of three catechumens, John Friedrich Knut, Mary Elizabeth Ograski, was confirmed in this church on May the 3rd, 1874. Because this location was so wet, it was decided not to put a floor into that church, but to erect another building in the northeast corner of the August Menzel homestead on Parrot Creek. This second of the congregation must have been erected during the summer of 1874. It was built of large hewed pine logs, was 26 feet long and 20 foot wide, and served as a house of worship until the summer of 1888. On August 22nd, 1886, it was again decided to build a new church. The cornerstone of the building, still standing there and known as the Valley Church, was laid in September of 1887, and the church was dedicated on July 29, 1888. This church measured 30 by 50 feet with a vestibule entrance on 8 by 10 feet. Toward the end of the century, service were also held in West Cliff for a long time, only once a month. In 1917, our present church was erected and dedicated. The building measures 35 by 75 feet with a tower, the cross of which reaches 96 feet above the ground. That's this church now in here.
Yes, Westcliff Church, right.
The total cost was $15,263. The Reverend J. Reininger planned and survived the building operation and also built the pulpit and altar. Pastor residence, Pastor Heyman, during the early past of his ministry here, boarded with Gottlieb Ograski and John Knut. Later he lived in a small log cabin on the John Knut place on Grape Creek. The outline of the foundation and fireplace on this building can still be recognized, though not now anymore.
No, that was written. Who wrote this?
I wrote this off. It was in the paper, you know, that the pastor had written, I guess.
Thank you.
Should I go on or?
Continue, yes.
Later, after his marriage in 1975, a partition was built through the church on Parrot Creek so that the rear part of the building might serve as the pastor's living quarters. In a meeting on December 16, 1877, during the parsonage of the Reverend J. H. Hirschman, it was decided to build a parsonage 28 by 28 feet in size. The pasture was chosen to serve as building supervisor, and the congregation promised to provide all the lumber. In 1893, a 12 by 28 foot addition was built on to the west, half of which was to serve as cellar and the other half as kitchen. On April the 28th, 1918, the congregation decided the pastor should live in town. A house was first rented, but soon some members bought another house, which was used until 1920, when the present parsonage was built at a cost of $5,240. Now it comes from the schools.
Yes, I was wondering when the Lutheran school was built and how long it lived and so forth.
The congregation's first special school building served till 1906, when it was torn down and frame structure 20 by 40 feet was erected. At our present location in town, the basement of the church has always served as a schoolroom. Even before the congregation had a special school building, the instruction of the children was by no means neglected. In his memoirs, written 25 years ago, Pastor Heyman refers to his experiences in school. After he had been teaching for a time, a secured certificate from county superintendent and also taught public school for a period of 4 months at $45 a month. In the first meeting conducted by the Reverend E.W. Saubert on January the 2nd, 1882, it was decided to put a new roof on the log church to make it more comfortable, because it also had to serve as school. And Mr. Nicholas Mansell was instructed to make more school benches. In September of that year, the congregation voted to make on exception to paragraph 22 of the Constitution and to permit the pastor to conduct a public school in the church building, but with special considerations for the parochial school.
Parochial? Oh, excuse me.
For many years, a confirmation school was conducted for about 6 months during the winter and for several months during the summer. A German school would be held teaching German reading and writing besides the catechism and Bible history. Schools was always taught by the various pastors until 1917, when the congregation resolved to call a regular teacher. The first teacher was Mr. R. Stulp. He could serve only one term until he was drafted to serve in the World War. The next term was taught by Miss Marie Melmer. Because of financial straits, the congregation in July 1919 voted to ask the pastor to teach the school again. But the next year, teacher J.L. Gunderman was called. In July of 1921, the congregation voted to grant him a peaceful dismissal. And on April the 2nd, 1922, it was reported to the congregation that Mr. C. Keller had accepted the congregation's call. He served as teacher till 1928, when he resigned. Since then, the following have taught the schools: student Otto Schleiermilch, 1928-29, student Arnold Wieding, September to December 29. To a student, T. A. Schultz, from January 1930 till June 1941, and candidate A.R. Bowman, 41 to 42. Now the pastors. When Pastor Heyman came to the valley in September of 1873, he found a happy little congregation, happy at the thought that now they could go to church every Sunday. The people were extremely poor, so poor that they could not promise their pastor a stimulated salary. But they did have something precious for their pastor, namely cordial love and esteem, which moved them to provide for their pastor according to their ability. He shepherded his little flock here faithfully until 1876, when ill health, chronic headaches, compelled him to resign from the ministry. He spent some time recuperating at his home in Missouri, and later devoted his life to teaching a parochial school. A vacancy of about a year must have followed then, when we find the Reverend J. L. Hirschman, who was up here for his health, tuberculosis, serving the congregation. Apparently he had been serving the congregation for some time already before the first meeting, of which we have record, December the 16, 1877. In this meeting, Pastor Hirschman was chosen by a unanimous vote as the congregation's pastor. He accepted the call in spite of his physical weakness an ailment, because the congregation promised to be satisfied with the services which he could render. In a special meeting on September the 21st, 1879, the congregation decided to join the Missouri Synod and authorized Pastor Hirschman to sign the Constitution of Synod at the Convention of the Western District, which was to convey during that week. In that same meeting, Pastor Hirschman ordered his resignation as pastor of the congregation because his increasing ill health would not permit him to teach school that winter. There must have been another vacancy of more than a year than from 1881 to 1883, the Reverend E.W. Salford was pastor of the congregation. Among those baptized by him and still members of the congregation are C.W. and Frank Kelling, Amelia Kitzman, Louis Hutbauer, and M.H. Lynch. The first couple married by Pastor Salford were F.W. Carr and Mattie Kimberlin of Rosita. The parents of our governor, Mr. Ralph L. Carr, also married by him, Robert Elsie and Martha Ograski, on April 16, 1882, still members of our congregation. From 1883 to 1885, the congregation was served by the Reverend L. W. Darnside, who was pastor of the congregation in Denver. The congregation's next pastor was the Reverend H.J. Miller, who served the congregation from January 1886 to 1894, when he followed a call to the congregation in New York. During this year, the congregation experienced a very rapid growth, so that in July of 1893, there were 52 voting members. Next, the Reverend Joseph Ish was called. He had been a traveling missionary, serving congregations and preaching stations in Nebraska, Colorado, southwestern Nebraska, and northeastern Kansas. His call simulated an annual salary of $350 with a promise of that would be increased if times and conditions would permit. Installed here in August 1894, he served till May of 1900, when he asked the congregation to grant him a peaceful dismissal because he would no longer endure the high altitude. Then several calls were issued, but without success. During the vacancy of more than 8 months, Pastor Hare of Denver was vacancy pastor, and a theological student, William Hiller of Denver, served the congregation, preaching and teaching school. Then followed the longest parsonage pastorate in the congregation's history, the Reverend Carl Lang having been installed in February of 1901, served till January 1913, when he followed a call to Troy, Illinois. He was succeeded by the Reverend O. Hooksalt, who was called on March the 9th, 1913, from Rocky Ford, and who served till January 1915, when he resigned from the ministry during the vacancy, which lasted more than a year. The congregation was served by the Reverend August E. Brower of Puebla. In March of 1915, he also ordained the Reverend Otto Voss, who, upon his graduation from the seminary in Springfield, Illinois, had been called to serve congregations in Brazil, South America. The Reverend J. Reining, a called from Clay Center, Kansas, was installed by Pastor Brower on March 6, 1916. After only 3.5 years of self-sacrificing labor, he died on September the 16th, 1919. After several unsuccessful calls, the Reverend Otto Herwagen, called from Topeka, Kansas, was installed as pastor of the congregation by the Reverend O. Listenhoff on March the 7th, 1920. He served till January of 1929, when he followed a call to congregation in Hinsdale, Illinois. The next pastor was the Reverend John Hink, called from Potter, Nebraska. His pastorate lasted from April 1929 to October 33. The Reverend R. Elmer Gunther of Ordway, having accepted the congregation's call, was installed in February of 1934 and served till January 1940, when he followed a call to congregation in San Bernardino, California. The present pastor, the Reverend G. A. Weinrich, formerly of Port Morgan, was installed by the pastor J. E. Herman on April the 7th, 1940. Membership. At the present time, your congregation numbers 223 baptized members, 158 communicants, and 50 voting members, 14 children attending the parochial school. During the past year, the Sunday school enrolled is 51. The present officers, Pastor G. A. Weinrich, elders F. H. Wagner, M. H. Lynch, H. W. Cassendick, Trustee C. W. Kelly, L. C. Hotpower, August Lang, School Board W. G. Henius, William F. Kelly, William Lang, Finance Committee Mel Cassendick, Henry Henning, and W. F. Schulze, Finance Secretary Frank H. Wagner, Treasurer Martin O. Rankin, Chairman Mel Cassendick, Secretary O. H. Voss, Head Ushers Martin Rankin and Chester Cassendick.
Now this is all 1940, mm-hmm. Right? Thank you. Do you have anything else there?
Organizations, the Ladies' Aid, and...
Okay, well, go right ahead. We might as well get all this while we're at it, okay?
Organizations. The Ladies' Aid was organized in June of 1916. Its present membership is 27. The officers are Mrs. Hedwig Menzel, President, Mrs. Margaret Strokey, Vice President, Mrs. Martha Jeske, Secretary, Mrs. Hedwig Hutbauer, Treasurer. The Young People's Society organized in July of 1920. Today, 20 members, officers Edwin Watts, President, Evelyn Miller, Vice President, Louisa Lindlof, Secretary, and Caroline Hutbauer, Treasurer, Julia L. Strilke, and Arnold Hutbauer, Executive Board Members. The Priscilla Club organized October the 17th, 1935, and consisting chiefly of the younger ladies in the congregation, has 19 members. Its officers are Mrs. Ruth Weinrich, President, Minnie Killing, Vice President, Mrs. Gladys Miller, Secretary, Mrs. Effie Cassendick, Treasurer, the Men's Club, now numbering 18 members, was organized July 1st, 1936. Officers Elmer Miller, President, August Ogreski, Vice President, Mel Kessendick, Secretary, Harry Schultz, Treasurer. Notes of interest. The following have been voting members for more than 40 years. Robert Elsie since April 31, 1882, 60 years. Louis Miller since January the 2nd, 1889, 50 years. Frank Wagner since October the 6th, 1901. Frank Killing, A.W.F. Killing, and Edward Menzel since January the 1st, 1902. In the meeting on October the 28th, 1888, it was decided to arrange a children's Christmas service on Christmas Eve, and that for this occasion a Christmas tree should be decorated in the church. The first mission festival was celebrated in July of 1890, April 6, 1902. It was decided to have services on Ascension Day from now on. July the 3rd, 1902, Mr. William Oppelbein was chosen as first delegate to represent the congregation of a district convention, which was held in Topeka that year. Each member was assessed $1.50 to pay traveling expenses for the pastor and lay delegate. Since our Colorado district was organized in 1921, several of the district's convention have been held in our midst. Reviewing our congregation's history, we are constrained to confess the Lord hath done great things for us, where we are glad. Psalm 126, verse 3.
Thank you. That's real good. And one thing I think we should say before we get away from this, even though the material you just gave us was in 1940, you wrote it. In 1967, you still have your wonderful Christmas program with the children doing the work on Christmas Eve.
Yeah.
And I know this is one of the outstanding things your church does every year, right?
Yeah.
And you have quite a number of youngsters participating now, I believe.
We have the Walter League.
Yes.
I don't know how many members there are now.
But they're quite active.
I'm still writing on this.
Good. You bring it up to 1967, and I'll be right back with my tape report. I have several questions I'd like to ask you. The pastor, Carl Lang, that served so long, now, is he a relative?
He was my husband's brother.
Okay.
But they're both gone.
Yes. But I thought I would establish that. I was sure that's where the first Lang that came into the area?
Yeah.
And now there are quite a lot of descendants, aren't there? Yes. What is meant by peaceful dismissal? You referred to that several times in your...
Well, that's it, that you were satisfied with your pastor, I think, and that you give him a peaceful dismissal so that there's nothing to come back on him. I don't know. I couldn't explain that.
Well, I guess it'd be similar to an honorable discharge from the service, right?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Something like that.
And you said that you sent out a call. That meant that you said there's a vacancy and would like to have a minister?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you established the fact that you're in the Missouri Synod.
Yeah.
Is that the way you pronounce that? S-Y-N-O-D?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Would you tell me, now, where did you go to school?
I went to school, they called it the Knut School there. It's from, well, where they first settled my father. And you know where Coleman lived.
William Coleman, yes.
Uh-huh. Well, there, my uncle lived there, and father lived right in the north of it.
I see.
Road. And then it was 2 miles up the road for where my schoolhouse, where I went to school.
Well, would they let anybody but Knut children go to school?
Yeah.
Just thought I'd ask. But for the most part, that's who went, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Tell me a little something about your schooling. Did you enjoy it? How long did you go each year and so forth?
Well, we only had 4 months of school. In winter, you know, that wasn't hardly enough, but we didn't have teachers at that time, you know, that could teach like now. Mm-hmm. So,
well, didn't the weather have something to do with it, too?
Well, not so much. Of course, sometimes it was bad weather, and then some of them, I guess, wouldn't go there, but...
Did you, do you recall what you learned? What did you study in school?
Reading and writing and arithmetic and history, grammar.
You didn't?
I only got through the fourth grade.
Why, you do real well, I tell you. Did you go by readers? Somebody was telling me the other day.
Yeah, they
you
had
graded by readers.
Barns they had. Mm-hmm. Readers. Hygiene, we had that too.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, did you have mostly men teachers, or did you have...
Well, we had some lady teachers, and we had Mrs. Hine, and there was another one, but I forgot her name. She was an elderly teacher, but she was a good teacher. But mostly we had men.
Right. You think of any outstanding incidents, any funny things that happened at school, or...?
Well, not so much.
Let's go back to this Christmas tree a minute. Do you remember when the Christmas trees were decorated with lighted candles?
Yeah, that's it was my time.
Mm-hmm. Was that more just beautiful than anything you see now?
Well, I don't know if it was just beautiful, but it was more dangerous. If those lights would fall, they'd start to burn, but we never did have an accident like that.
Mm-hmm. Did you have these at home as well as at church?
Yeah, we always had a tree at home. Father said it wasn't Christmas if we didn't have a tree.
Right. Was Father the domineering influence at home?
Yeah.
He definitely was a disciplinarian and probably the man that set the pace for everything, right?
Yeah.
Whatever he said, you did. At what age were you married, Mrs. Wine?
What year?
At what age?
No, how old were you? 21 and a half, I guess.
Well, did you work before you were married out of the home at all?
No. I just helped my father see. I didn't have no brothers, and I worked like a man.
Oh, you were outside most of the time.
Yeah.
Well, tell me a little bit about the farming at that time.
Oh, it was everything handwork, you know, where you have now the load these push rakes, and now they have the balers, you know. You had to take the wagon and horses, and you'd have to rake the hay, and then you'd have to put it on the wagon by hand, and then unload it on the stack and stack it. And
how long did it take you to make hay?
Oh, just about the season that they always use.
All summer.
Mm-hmm.
I bet most of it, right? Oh, okay.
And then we'd raise grain, you know.
What kind of grain?
oats and barley and wheat, and Father would cut and I would chop. Mm-hmm. So my other sisters were gone then, they was married.
And you said you were the youngest.
Uh-huh.
You were the youngest child. Mm-hmm. So you were your father's right-hand farm.
Yeah.
Hand, right?
Mm-hmm. I'd done everything except run a binder. I plowed and harrowed and drilled.
Did you have a nice riding plow or did you have a walking plow?
No, we had a riding plow.
Oh, mm-hmm. You were real elite.
Yeah.
How much acreage did your father farm?
Well, there was 160, but there was some pasture and some hayland and some plowed ground.
Mm-hmm. What kind of cattle did you have?
Just a common cattle.
Just mixed up?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Do you remember any real unusual characters, unusual people that you like to tell us about? Outstanding people, maybe somebody that was a big influence on your life, or?
Well, I can't think of anything just right now.
Mm-hmm. Well, you think about it a little. I always come back and you think of something that you've left out. But this is one thing we would like to know about, or, you know, real outstanding people, if you can think of them. Now, I don't quite know how to put this question, but do you think your strong church today is because of the strong tie that the Germans had with their Lutheran church when they first came? You've seen a lot of the years of the church, and you've seen it stand steady and stay, and of course you no longer have your school.
No.
But that became financially impossible, and then you had too few students, I believe, right?
Yeah.
But definitely your hope. That's not right. What's the name of your Lutheran church?
Our church is Hope Lutheran Church.
Hope Lutheran, okay. Mm-hmm. And for a moment I thought I was wrong. The Hope Lutheran is very definitely an outstanding example of a strong church in this day and age. Yeah. I just wondered what you attributed that to. That's what I was trying to ask you.
Well, everybody, as much as he can. I pay $1.75 a week.
you tithe in your church.
Yeah.
You think that's
mm-hmm.
One of the main reasons that it is real important. Do you... You don't have a resident minister.
Yes, now we have
Reverend Albers, I believe.
Of course, it depends on how long he stays and how many years, you know.
But he doesn't live here. That's
no,
what I
mean. Well, he wants to live here a few months in summer.
Oh.
He lives in Salida.
Right. And he also preaches at Salida?
Yeah. Right. He's got the two places.
I see. Okay. Can you tell me anything about your social life after your sisters, after you were through with your schooling and so forth? Did most of your social life revolve around the church?
Yeah.
You came to meetings and so forth? And
yeah.
Were you in the choir and that type of thing?
Yeah, I was in the choir.
But did you go to dances and...
Oh, not much.
Not much. I don't think I'm going to find out. I just don't believe you're going to answer my question, right? Do you remember anything about the railroads when they were in here?
Well, just this little railroad. I don't remember what year it was.
Is this in the old country?
Mm-hmm, from the old country.
And she worked out as a young lady?
Mm-hmm.
Do you recall anything that she told you about the difference in their life in Germany and their life here?
Yeah, see, here they had a little bit better than in Germany. They was kind of poor too, poor people, and they would go
to the, well, I guess you'd call it the sea or something, ocean, I don't know, just, and they'd do their rinsing with their clothes there. And in winter, I said that was terrible when in that cold water.
Icy, right? Beat their clothes with rocks, probably, uh-huh. That type thing, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I guess her mother and father died before she was really of poor age, you know. And she worked at her brother first, and then after a while she took another job to another place.
I see. Mary Mullins told me when I talked with her here a while back how excited she was when she saw that her father had horses.
Mm-hmm.
She'd come over because she said she had never seen a horse in Germany except pulling a beer wagon. Did your mother ever make any reference like that?
No, I'm...
You don't recall no. that? Do you know they came in with an oxen team?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's good to establish. Maybe we'll find out just the route. Now, I have a friend that's sure they came up Oak Creek, but I am not sure anymore. I'm getting confused. So we'll see if we can find someone that can really tell me. Is there anything else that you think of right now, Mrs. Lang, that we haven't touched? You really gave us a lot of good church history there, and I thank you very much for it.
Well, that's right. No, I don't. If I think of something, I'll just jot it down a little bit.
Okay.